So if the buyer is going to give you this prime piece of real estate, you need to be able to convince the buyer that you'll be able to outperform whatever product you're replacing on the shelf. Because unfortunately, these shelves aren't getting bigger, these stores are not getting bigger. If anything, the plant-based fixture is rationalizing and is getting smaller. So you really need to be able to justify why you should be on the shelf, the point of difference that you have compared to the other brands. What shoppers are you going to bring to the shelf that the category isn't otherwise already bringing in? And how are you going to maintain a high rate of sale? So how are you going to make sure that your products just keep on moving off the shelf? Because that's how these retailers make their money.
We see ourselves as really trying to create a new sort of subcategory within plant-based of this sort of more whole food protein, and doing that alongside, tofu and all, great products like that. But in doing that, we really had to earn the trust of these buyers that we understood what the demand was, what our customers were looking for. And so we've done so much research over the years of how we can do that and also how we can get people to adopt tempeh as this new food that a lot of people haven't heard of. So I think that was really key as well.
Hi there, I've got some great guests coming up in the pipeline, so do please subscribe so you don't miss out. Now back to the show. Hi there, and welcome to Plant CEO. In today's episode, I'd like to welcome Ellen Roberts, the co-founder and CMO, and Chris Kong, the co-founder and CEO of Better Nature Tempeh. How are you both doing?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, very well. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, lovely to meet you.
Great to meet you too. Where are you dialing in today from?
From Nine Elms in London, so near Vauxhall.
At a food exchange where there's some other plant-based companies there with you.
Exactly. Yeah, we're among great company like Tyndall, Manulife, Oggs, so many great companies.
Perfect. So do you get to share notes with them now and again, I guess?
Yeah, every now and again. Just the other week, we were invited to have dinner together at Mission Kitchen, which is like a co-working sort of kitchen space just downstairs. So yeah, sometimes we get to hang out, share notes, have a chat.
We had lunch with Oggs the other day.
We had lunch with Oggs, yeah.
All the teams. Did
they feed you lots of cake?
Yes.
Yeah.
We got tempeh for lunch and then they had the cake for dessert. So it was perfect. Yeah.
It was amazing.
Nice little exchange there going on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. So what inspired you to create Better Nature Tempeh? And what were some of the challenges that you faced along the way?
Yeah, the story, I guess, for me, started when I was at university. So Ellen and I, we both went to uni together. I was doing, a biochemistry degree. Ellen studied psychology. And, I guess the notion or the idea of being vegetarian, let alone vegan, never, ever crossed my mind prior to uni. But when I was there under Ellen's influence, I started thinking a lot more about where my protein was coming from. But I've always been quite athletic. So at school, I was a rower. When I, when I started at uni, I picked up boxing. So for me, having a stable source of high quality protein was really important. And served as the main feature of whatever meal I was having. So back in the day, I was eating a lot of chicken breast. As a result, I wanted something that was high in protein and something that I could really use in all sorts of different dishes, something that was really easy, versatile, didn't have to really think twice about it. But when Ellen, inspired me to start thinking more about, where does this chicken come from? How was it raised and slaughtered, et cetera, the impact it was not only having on the environment, but also, the ethical conundrum of consuming animal-based proteins, of course, the health considerations as well. I started thinking, okay, if I'm going to take chicken out of my diet, what can I replace it with instead? And going to supermarket shelves at that time, there really wasn't a go-to source of plant-based protein that I felt that I could really adopt as a staple, at one end of the spectrum. And I know things have changed a lot now, put this into perspective or into context, this was around 2016, 2017 time. And I know the market has evolved, but largely still, plant-based products fall into two camps. You've either got your meat alternatives, or you've got your more all-natural, more whole foods proteins, like tofu and falafel. Meat alternatives, they're great, they taste great, super easy to cook, but they weren't products that I felt comfortable eating on a daily basis. Whether it's because they have really long ingredients lists. Yeah, I didn't think they were naturally like the most healthy options available out there. And at the other end of the spectrum, looking at tofu and falafel, again, great products, but not products I felt like I could eat day in and day out. You know, there's only so much tofu, I feel, or falafel that any one person could eat on a given week. So I was really on the hunt, and I was desperate, really, for this source of go-to plant-based protein that I could eat day in and day out. And that's when I met Driando. So Driando is another co-founder. He's our CTO. And he grew up in Indonesia, where tempeh comes from. And he was, he's been eating tempeh since he was literally a newborn baby. It's like he was fed tempeh as his weaning food. And he did his PhD in food science in the US. But he comes from a family of food scientists. So his mother's a food scientist, the grandfather's a food scientist, and they're all just equally obsessed about tempeh. So when we met just by happenstance at university, and he was telling me all about his PhD on tempeh and tempeh in general, I was, frankly speaking, I thought he was, blowing hot air. Like, I didn't think that this food product could actually exist. So he invited me out to go to Indonesia to hang out with him and his family. So I took that opportunity and was just blown away about how commonplace tempeh was in Indonesia. It's literally served on every street corner. Everybody knew what it was. And when I came back to the UK, I just could not believe that a food product that is so widely consumed as a staple for, almost 300 million people in Indonesia had no resonance whatsoever in the UK. And I saw that as a huge opportunity, right? To be able to introduce this amazing food product, which had been around for hundreds of years, to the UK consumer who so desperately needs a healthy, nutritious source of protein that's also sustainable, right? So when that all sort of came together, I literally just graduated from university at the time. The first person I called up was Ellen, who had a couple of years of marketing experience under her belt at that time, to really, to join us on this crazy adventure.
Indeed. Yeah, I remember Chris telling me about tempeh, and I'd had tempeh once before, but I think I'd had like the canned version, which is very soft. And I, to be honest, wasn't a very big fan, which I find so funny now. So when Chris was telling me, and he was like, oh, this food is incredible, like you have to try it. Like, honestly, his energy was unbelievable. I was like, okay, Chris, like Chris is a very enthusiastic person. I don't know if you've been able to tell. So I was a bit like, okay, yeah, sure. And then I went and actually had properly cooked tempeh, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. So yeah, and then we were like, we have to do something about it. And yeah, we were lucky to find, also Fabio joined on the journey as well. So Fabio had been traveling around Indonesia, his background's in nutrition, and he also fell in love with tempeh. He just couldn't believe that a food so nutritious could also be so delicious, could be so accessible. And he was like, why are people not eating this across the world? So then he reached out to Driando, because Driando sort of, if you Google tempeh, he's all over that. So he looked him up, reached out to him. And then, yeah, we kind of thought, actually, we had very sort of complementary skill sets, didn't we? And we all sort of were joined together by a passion to bring tempeh into the mainstream. And then that was, gosh, was it like 4.5 years ago now?
Yeah, something like that. early 2019.
Yeah.
Early to mid 2019.
Great story. And just thinking back when you both met at Oxford, right? Uni. Ellen, what was your own journey in going plant-based?
I first went vegetarian when I was 15. So it was actually inspired by a documentary about fish when I watched in geography class. Well, basically about the seas, but overfishing essentially, and what that was doing to, seas and oceans across the world and the devastating impact of that. So I bizarrely kind of went home that day and told my mom that I'm not eating fish anymore. And I think she was quite confused, because I don't think many people do it that way around, but I decided. And then from that, I started looking more into like meat, and I was like, oh, I don't feel comfortable about this either. So then I decided to go veggie and actually did it with my sister, who's a couple of years older than me. She decided to join me. And then a few years later, I was 18, my sister went vegan. She looked more into sort of dairy and eggs and was just like, oh, this doesn't sit comfortably with me in terms of ethics, but also she was looking into the health side of things. And so she told me all about it and I was like, okay, I'll go vegan with you. So we kind of helped each other out with some big life changes. And then, yeah, haven't looked back since. So that was 10 years ago now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. 10 years ago. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating when you sort of put the time back of like, how was the world then, especially in retail and buying stuff that's more convenient to buy. Do you remember what the documentary was that you watched when you were 15?
No, I really don't. I think it was just quite like a generic sort of overfishing one. And I don't think my geography teacher probably thought that it was going to have quite the impact on me, at least, that it did. I think it was more just learning more about the oceans. And no, I don't actually remember the specific one.
Yeah. So then when you met Chris, how did you go about convincing him to switch as well? And what was his normal thing of saying no? Did he debate it with you? Obviously, you know, there's some videos at the moment I think I shared with you on the vegan debate at Oxford. But what was his pushback initially?
I don't really remember, to be honest. I don't always think he was open to learning. Mm. I think you were I think he was curious for quite a while. And then it took a long time for you to actually make the change, right? But I think you were curious for a long time. And I think you joined uni being very passionate about the environment, right? So I think that was like, the interest was there. I think it was just so foreign to you. You were like, I could not imagine doing that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I went to an all-boys boarding school, for example. Like, no one was vegan or vegetarian, right? Like, literally nobody. I mean, unless perhaps for like some religious reason, right? But I didn't know a single vegan or vegetarian growing up. And, you know, before I went to boarding school, I was born in Hong Kong and I lived there for 13 years. And again, the whole idea of being a vegan or vegetarian is completely foreign to Hong Kongers, very much foreign in China as well. So when I came to university, I think I was just open to experiencing new things. I was open to meeting new people. You know, I didn't want to just hang around stuck up posh boys, you know, any longer. I wanted to sort of experience, new cultures, new ideas. So I think I was very receptive. And I think it started more with, okay, I kind of get it, but I still don't want to lose out on eating meat. What are these simple swaps that I could make in order to at least somewhat reduce my meat consumption? So I think first it started off breakfast, because my breakfast was normally like granola or porridge, or, you know, maybe even sometimes sausages and eggs, quite heavy stuff, at least, you know, for like the typical English breakfast. And I was like, what if I just had veggie sausages instead? And I think we were very fortunate to have gone to a college. So we both went to Brasenose that were very open to trying out new foods. Okay, sorry, that was my sort of experience.
There was a lot behind the scenes that I had to do. I was pushing quite hard. Because when I joined, like genuinely for my first year, what I predominantly eat was potatoes and salad. Options were very limited for dinner. So I had quite a lot of meetings with the kitchen. And I also, in my second year, I was like the environment and charities rep as well. So also from that perspective, trying to think like, how can we cut the carbon footprint of the college, especially through our food? So yes, I had many a meeting, but in the end, like they were very receptive. I think it just takes time for people. I think they're, you know, at first they were a bit, you know, affronted, and also I think it's the fact that they have a big responsibility. You know, they feel the responsibility of feeding these young people. They want people to enjoy their food. A lot of pressures coming different ways. So I think for them, they just wanted to make sure they were serving up sort of good quality, you know, in their mind, healthy food. And, you know, my way of doing that maybe was a bit different to what they had been used to in the past. But in the end, they were. And now they're, you know, I think they always tops, you know, the one of the most vegan-friendly colleges in Oxford, which is great. I've been back quite a few times since, and the options are sort of even better than when I was there, which is amazing. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when your friendship circles slowly all start adopting this diet, you start thinking, am I the only one not on this sort of bandwagon. I'm only the odd one out. And I think as humans, we all have a craving for belonging, right? So I started really thinking, okay, what if I tried doing a little bit more? And I think the real switch came when I stopped eating beef for ethical reasons mainly, right? I think that was the big switch for me. It wasn't so much environmental, even though I think that's what got me on board initially. It got me interested in the topic, just understanding the environmental consequences of my diet. But I think the first switch came when I realized, well, I can't kill a cow. Why should I eat beef? Mm. And yeah. once I made that decision, okay, I can't eat what I can't kill. Then slowly but surely, I was like, well, I can't kill a pig either. You know, chickens, like, I can't do that. And then boom, you know, I was vegan.
yeah, awesome. That's great to hear. And tell me about the process of making tempeh for the people who don't know. That I think it'll be good to cover that.
Yeah, I think you do a better job than me.
Sure. So tempeh is super easy to make. And again, I mentioned earlier, it's been around for hundreds of years. It's pretty much as minimally processed as you can get. And simply put, tempeh is fermented whole soybeans. So how it's made, whether traditionally or in factories these days, is you start off with your plain soybeans. You cook them, right? So whether you cook in the pan or a pasta cooker at the industrial scale, you still cook them. You let it cool. You add in your starter culture, which is really that secret sauce. You can think of it as like analogous to the mother of a sourdough, right? It's what kickstarts the fermentation process, what drives the fermentation process. And in tempeh, the starter culture that we use are actually mushroom spores. So tempeh can really be thought of as this like beautiful marriage between beans, soybeans, and mushrooms, right?
Okay.
It's called inoculating, right? But really it's just like tossing a bit of the starter culture in, mixing it up, and then you put it in a warm room for anywhere between 2 to 3 days. And what comes out is this white cake, right? Which is tempeh. And that cake can be chopped up into pieces, into slices. It could be minced. It can be done. It can really be formed in any way that you like.
And using this mushroom as a starter culture, is that something that is quite common with other producers, I guess?
So, I mean, other producers of tempeh?
Yeah.
So it is quite common. I mean, it's the only way you can make tempeh is by using these mushroom spores. But the really cool thing like that these mushroom spores do is that it affects the nutritional content, it affects the taste, and I think really like miraculously affects this texture. Right. Because you think about it, 2 to 3 days ago, all you're holding in your hand is a bag of boiled soybeans. 2 to 3 days later, it becomes this cake. Right. So how does that happen? Well, it happens because what the mushroom spores do once it's being warmed up and once it's sort of mixed in with the soybeans is that they germinate and they grow and they form this network of mycelium. Right. Yeah. Which I think is, quite well understood these days. This mycelium that eats away at the carbs and the fat of the soybeans, but produces itself protein. So what happens, when you start off your bag of boiled soybeans, you ferment it, what you end up doing is that you reduce the fat and carbohydrate content by about 50%, but you increase the protein content by about 30%, having really not done anything apart from leaving it in a warm room, which in Indonesia is literally the entire country, right?
Yeah.
But the mycelium has this added benefit of binding all the soybeans together, right? In this really tight mesh and gives it that firm, more meaty texture.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what about the type of mushroom? I mean, do people use a variety of mushrooms? What sort of mushrooms are they using?
Yeah, exactly. So it's very specific, I guess, genus of mushrooms called Rhizopus. So typically it's either Rhizopus oligosporus. You can also use other species of Rhizopus like Rhizopus oryzae, but it's typically from, species within that family.
Okay. And I guess also, like in connection with mushrooms in general, there's so much that we don't know, right? And there's a lot of research that still needs to happen in the types of mushrooms and the effects that it has on your brain and also, I guess, your gut.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's so little that we know about mushrooms because the mushrooms that we know of that have fruiting bodies above the ground that are visible, right, when we say go to a forest, for example, are only just a very, very, small subset of the encyclopedia of mushrooms that exist. Most mushrooms don't have a fruiting body. Most mushrooms exist purely below the ground.
And it's also the network they formed and how they communicate with each other and also let other species know, I guess, especially like trees, right? For having that network in place helps trees communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just reading a book called Regenesis, written by Georges Monbiot, and he talks about how you have this amazing rhizome, right, underneath the ground. We talk about the biome, we talk about like the microbiome in our guts, but in soils, you have this incredible rhizome, which is like the interconnections between mushrooms, trees, different plants. And you also have, I guess, yeah, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but the bacteria that live within the soils as well, and how that all sort of interconnects and plays with each other. So
That's
cool.
right. Yeah, and then I guess the other topic, big topic, is around psychedelics and also the effects that it could help people with mental health issues as well. Yeah.
Definitely.
So great. So let's talk about your products. So you've got organic products, you've got your marinated ones, which is the barbecue, the Mediterranean, the curried, and the smoky one. Which one is your best seller and why? And also, how do you decide what flavors you want to create next?
Yeah, sure. So our best seller is our plain organic, which actually came as a surprise to us. I think we thought that it would be more of the flavored options. We thought, okay, a lot of people don't know what tempeh is, so they'll want something that's sort of pre-cut, pre-seasoned, ready to go. But actually, what we sort of found is quite similar to what Chris was saying earlier about his own journey with tempeh, is that people are really looking for that staple. They're looking for something that they can buy, put in their fridge. It's got a great shelf life because we pasteurize our tempeh just to keep it safe.
How long does it last, by the way?
So from production, it's about 240 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So on average, people are buying it, it will have about 6 months of shelf life.
It doesn't necessarily need to be placed in the fridge, or
It
because
does need to be in
it's
the fridge.
oh, okay, and
Yeah.
it's because it's vacuum sealed as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It
Yeah.
does need to be in the fridge. But what we're finding is that people are sort of buying quite a few, stocking them in the fridge. And then when they want to have a stir fry using it, when they want to have a pasta using it, if they want to, grate it into their bolognese, they're using it. And actually, people are kind of really liking that versatility of the plain block. And that's something that, we want to showcase even more of all the things you can do with it, because it is genuinely amazing. I shared on LinkedIn the other day that I made a tempeh smoothie.
Yeah,
It was so good, and like super high in protein, high in fiber, and like genuinely just tasted great. So it's amazing what you can do with tempeh. So I guess for us, in terms of like future products, it's about how we can make it easier for people to use tempeh, but also maintain that versatility. So for us, looking at sort of more lightly seasoned products, but still maybe in pieces or in chunks or whatever, so they kind of know it's straight, it can go straight in the pan, straight in the wok, straight in the air fryer, whatever they like, and then they can add whatever flavor they want. Because also what we find is that because tempeh is an Asian food, or it's Indonesian food, sometimes people think, oh, it can just be used in Asian dishes, and that's something that we really want to kind of push against, because it's just not true. Obviously, you can use it in anything. It takes on the flavor of whatever you cook it in. And so we've actually found that people responded really well to that. We've got, as you say, our Mediterranean pieces, and they're the second most popular product. And people love it because they can put it in their pasta, can put it in a salad, put it in a wrap, whatever you want. So yeah, for us, it's about how we can really create those healthy, versatile protein staples using tempeh.
Yeah, and the marinated one, after it's marinated, are you sort of baking it, frying it? What process do you have with those ones?
Once it's marinated, we just put it in the tray and we pasteurize it. That's all we
Oh,
do.
okay.
Yeah.
And then however you want to cook it at home then would
Yeah.
be that. Yeah, cool.
Exactly. You can pop it in the microwave. It's not probably the optimal flavor experience, but I think it's great personally. I think it's very convenient. But the ideal thing to do is fry it, air fry it, bake it, something like that, which kind of gets it a bit crispy, I think is the ideal way of cooking it.
Yeah, are the flavored ones also organic?
No, they're not. They're
Right,
not.
so there is a difference between the two.
I guess in terms of nutritional profile, slightly. In fact, the marinated products are higher in protein, but that's only because I guess the process of marinating, et cetera, sometimes takes out a bit of the water from within the tempeh, some of the moisture. But in terms of taste, right, if you take out the marinades, of course, like it's identical.
Oh, so the taste is the same, even if you take out the, yeah. I guess
Yes.
it's just how it's been produced then, and the soil that it was in, and sometimes that has limitations on scale, I guess.
Our mission is to get 100 million people eating tempeh. So 100 million new people eating tempeh by 2030. And we feel that the only way we can do that is by making tempeh as accessible as possible. If we were to use organic soybeans for our marinated products, they'd be way too expensive. And they'd
Right.
be priced out of many people's shopping baskets, which we think would be a great shame because it could be a way to capture audiences that don't know what tempeh is, but are looking for this convenient, healthy, nutritious, sort of protein to add to the dishes. So yeah, we made the decision to go make those marinated products non-organic in order to drive the prices down to make tempeh far more accessible.
Yeah. And what was your sort of retail price for those? What's the difference?
Yes, they were organic.
Yeah.
We're talking about £3.49, but we currently sell the non-organic ones for £2.75.
Right.
And
Okay.
we're thinking about, considerable cost saving there.
Yeah. And I guess if I'm just trying to think of sort of the price of tofu in comparison of organic tofu. That varies, I guess, between it depends on the grams, actually. I guess if it's a 200 gram block, I guess it between depending on what the retailers have on their offers, whatever, it could be anywhere like £2.50 to £3 something, I guess.
Yeah, tofu is usually like quite a bit cheaper than tempeh, but that's predominantly because it's, so much of it is water content in the sense, whereas tempeh is, almost entirely soybeans and obviously fermented as well, so the whole process behind that. So yeah, we do find that, it's probably on average about 50p more expensive tempeh.
Okay. What about the protein content compared to tofu to tempeh?
The protein content of tofu does massively vary across types of tofu, in terms of obviously silken tofu, firm tofu, but also across brands. But on average, it usually sits around 12, 13 grams per 100 grams, whereas
Yeah.
our products are anywhere between 19 to 24 grams per 100 grams.
Okay.
So it is
Okay.
quite a bit more. And I think also, but the bigger sort of difference is fiber. So with tofu, it's very low in fiber. I think it's always under a gram, whereas for us, we're about 7 grams of fiber per 100 grams. So you do
Yeah.
get more because you're keeping the soybeans whole.
100%. Yeah. That's really important because you need the fiber to absorb the protein in. We're very deficient actually in fiber compared to protein as
Definitely.
well.
Yeah.
100%. And I think a lot of, processing methods, especially in the food industry, takes fiber out of, plants that have loads of it in. So if you think about tofu production, for example, what you do is that you get your soybeans, but you milk them. Right. So, and you collect the soy milk and you coagulate the soy milk. But what you do in that process is that you effectively discard quite a bit of the soybean, right? So everything that doesn't otherwise go into the milk effectively gets discarded as waste. But in tempeh, because we ferment the whole bean, all the nutrients that are otherwise in the bean are still present in the final end product.
Yeah,
So it's
great.
less waste as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then that's an important one. You've done really well to get in a number of retailers now. So you're in, yeah,
Lidl,
it's Lidl.
Asda, Tesco, Planet Organic,
Yeah.
Whole Foods, Rewe in Germany, exactly.
Yeah. Are you working on Aldi? Is that one that you have your targets on?
We're not actively sort of pursuing working with the discounters. I guess the arrangement we have a Lidl works really well in our favor because we're only in there for like 1 week a quarter, effectively. But in that 1 week, we get to reach, all approximately 1,000 Lidl stores, and we
Right.
effectively blast, Lidl customers with our product, which is an amazing way for us to build brand awareness, get people to try tempeh. But in terms of a longer term sales opportunity, we don't think it's the right fit for the brand right now. It's
in
something
terms of pricing, because we have to go at a much lower price point. So we go basically price there like we do in promotions elsewhere. So that's why we basically see it as a promotion, essentially.
Right.
But it doesn't work long term at that point.
Yeah. So do they normally put it out only when they're obviously do they market it on their, you know, their in-store leaflets that they have when it's coming up in that particular quarter? Do they always have it in, or is it, because I'm just thinking those consumers, how they know that is going to be in there if they liked it and they always shop there, I guess.
I think that's just the way that Lidl is, right? I think like a lot of Lidl shoppers sort of expect that. They sort of know that things go on rotation and they have different weeks. So I know our co-founder Fabio, he shops at his local Lidl and he gets very excited when it's Italian week at Lidl. It goes wild. But I think he sort of knows, you know, he knows he'll get those products then and then they'll rotate back again in a few months. So I think that's kind of what we've heard from when we've spoken to people is that they shop at Lidl, but they also shop elsewhere. So they kind of do their basics. They know they absolutely need to get elsewhere. And then they go to Lidl to be like, well, what deals can I get? What new things can I, you know, can I find? Which is actually great for us, because that's a great mindset for people to discover tempeh for the first time. It's something they're just like, ooh, you know, what's this new thing? And obviously, you know, the fact that we go back again and again, it just helps to sort of build that up even more.
Yeah,
interesting. And I guess, if they do find it there, they can always go to the bigger supermarkets, right? The bigger chains to buy the product.
Exactly. All the information's on our pack, so they can just look us up and then find it. Exactly.
Yeah, awesome. So how did you work in getting involved with some of the larger retailers, nationwide ones?
Yeah, there is no silver bullet, I'm afraid, of getting listings with these major retailers. I think a lot of it, for us, I think what we adopted was the mindset of the buyer, right? And we tried our very best to put ourselves in the buyer's shoes to understand exactly what the buyer is looking for. And essentially, if you think about it, right, shelf space in these retailers is effectively real estate, right? And every product sold, the buyer gets paid. So if the buyer is going to give you this prime piece of real estate, you need to be able to convince the buyer that you'll be able to outperform whatever product you're replacing on the shelf. Because unfortunately, these shelves aren't getting bigger. These stores are not getting bigger. If anything, the plant-based fixture is rationalizing and is getting smaller. So you really need to be able to justify why you should be on the shelf, the point of difference that you have compared to the other brands, what shoppers are you going to bring to the shelf that the category isn't otherwise already bringing in, and how are you going to maintain a high rate of sale? So how are you going to make sure that your products just keep on moving off the shelf? Because that's how these retailers make their money. So by putting ourselves in their shoes, what we had to do was effectively help them build confidence in our brand. And one way of doing that is by showcasing wins in other smaller channels, right? So showcasing how we're winning in the independents, how we're winning in food service, how all these amazing brand partnerships that we've got. So by sort of taking on that, I guess, strategy, we started off establishing ourselves in the smaller independent retailers. So, you know, your local mom and pop organic food store. I mean, there are actually about 1,000 of these stores across the UK. So it can be quite a significant market if you could capture all of them. So we started off there. We still actually currently sell through there, but we started off there as a base. We then got into food service. So we got listings secured with Bidfood. We had an amazing partnership with Mindful Chef. And by sort of building all of these small wins and by communicating them to the buyer and by aligning these wins with what the consumer is looking for, and by showcasing that consumers are becoming increasingly interested in these sorts of products, we were able to finally win that listing.
Yeah.
So I think we over-indexed quite a lot on like research as well, right? Mm. I think being that trusted partner, especially because, you know, if you looked at the fixture 2 or 3 years ago, it was predominantly meat alternatives, right? Like that was really how things looked. And as Chris said, there was a little bit of tofu and falafel, but, you know, it's kind of sidelined in many ways. And so for us, we don't, you know, we see ourselves as really trying to create a new sort of subcategory within plant-based of this sort of more whole food protein, you know, and doing that alongside, you know, tofu and all, you know, great products like that. But in doing that, you know, we really had to earn the trust of these buyers, that we understood what the demand was, what our customers were looking for. And so we've done so much research over the years of how we can do that, and also how we can get people to adopt tempeh as this new food that a lot of people haven't heard of. So I think that was really key as well.
And Ellen, how would you describe your shoppers as an audience, or have you sort of split your audiences up in some ways?
We sort of try not to split them up too much. I think especially as a small brand, we think it's really important to have almost one shopper in our mind. And that doesn't mean, obviously, you know, we don't have just one shopper. We have a variety of shoppers, but we try and sort of bring in what we think are the key things that make someone interested in our product into one person. So we have this sort of target customer called Sasha. There are kind of two key things that make her interested in our product. So she's very health conscious. So we know that people come, you know, they come to the plant-based shelf for a whole variety of reasons. It could be for sustainability, it could be for, you know, animals, it could be for anything. But we know what makes people choose our products over other products at the shelf is health related. You know, we are seen as the sort of healthiest plant-based option. And that's something that, you know, is important to us to be single-minded and clear. And also what we're seeing actually is people that wouldn't even consider shopping from plant-based before coming into the category to buy our product, because it really fits what they're looking for in terms of, you know, there might be someone that's really looking to drive up, you know, their protein intake or their fiber intake or whatever, and kind of trying to cut down meat as well. So that's the second criteria, is someone that's looking to add more plants to their diet in general. And that doesn't necessarily mean someone that's, you know, cutting meat out, or even, you know, they might even still be eating meat in every meal, but they're trying to add more variety, they're trying to add more plants. And so we find that those are the two main drivers of why people are interested in our products. And if they meet those two criteria, we find time and time again that our proposition is quite compelling to them. So for us, sort of Sasha is someone that, you know, is trying to, we kind of internally have this phrase of sort of racking up her health points. So she wants to, you know, she wants to eat well, she wants to go to a yoga class, she wants to go to a fitness class, all about sort of racking up those health points that make her feel good, make her feel like she's looking after herself. But then when she wants to indulge, when she wants to go out and have a burger with friends, or, you know, she wants to go on a, you know, to the pub or whatever, she's happy to do that. It's all about balance. And that's what we find our customers, you know, are not people that want to cut everything out and are really strict, because, yeah, I mean, that's also a very, you know, quite a small subsection of society. And for us, being a mainstream brand is really, really important. We just don't want to go after people that are in a niche. Obviously, you know, we love vegans. We're vegans ourselves, but that's just not going to result in, you know, us creating a mainstream business and also having mainstream impact, which is what's really important to us. So yeah, that's kind of what we've created the brand around, is people that are looking for that balance, looking to add, you know, great, delicious, nutritious foods into their lives without feeling they need to necessarily cut things out all the time. And I think in doing that as well, it's a really positive approach that we find really resonates and actually gets people excited about eating more plant-based foods, which is very much the ethos that we have. And, you know, that's what we think is actually going to result in mainstream change.
Yeah. And in terms of marketing to Sasha, I guess, how do you go about that as a strategy for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, lots of different things, really. But I mean, I think for us, trying to embed ourselves as a protein staple in Sasha's life, essentially, is what we try and do. And that's sort of aligned also with sales, that kind of is across the business. But, you know, when we think about how we can do that, that's sort of, you know, working with nutritionists, for example, that are sort of advising people. We do a lot of stuff in PR, we do social, we do brand partnerships, always rooted though in that sort of health consciousness, and also looking for those more sort of simple recipes. Like, we're never going to be in a really indulgent recipe by like a top, you know, chef that's, you know, Michelin star. Like, that's not our product necessarily. We'd love to see tempeh there, we think it has every right to be there. But, you know, what we always try and think is, you know, what's going to actually make someone pick us out, what's actually going to make someone sort of, you know, tempeh jump out at someone. And it's not going to be for the fact that it's this top culinary product, it's going to be the fact that it's unbelievably healthy and nutritious, and it's also delicious as well. And it's going to make it very easy for you to make quick, healthy, delicious, you know, also plant-based meals, or doesn't even have to be plant-based. It could be that you're swapping some animal protein out, having tempeh instead, but just sort of meeting our customer where they're at and where they're making those decisions around where they're consuming healthy proteins, and trying to sort of, yeah, get them to know more about tempeh. That's really our key approach when it comes to marketing.
Do you both, I guess, personally have your own favorite recipe that you love?
I think we both have the same favorite recipe. I mean, it's really hard to beat. So it's this amazing traditional Indonesian tempeh recipe called tempeh ketup. And ketsup is like this sweet Indonesian soy sauce, super indulgent. And it's just deep fried tempeh coated in this sweet Indonesian soy sauce with all these amazing aromatics like bay leaves, fried shallots, lemongrass, and garlic, ginger. And it just, it smells and tastes incredible. And you just serve it very simply on a bowl of, you know, freshly steamed white rice. There's really nothing.
Yeah. It's ironic, because obviously what I just said is that tempeh is not seen as especially indulgent. So it's funny because it definitely can be, as you say.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of obviously our favorite foods, and I have it, you know, and that's what I think what's so great about it is you can have it in something like that, or you could have it, you know, popped in your air fryer with some, you know, a little bit of soy sauce, ginger and garlic, and then some broccoli and some rice or whatever, and you're ready to go as well. So, you know, you can kind of dial it up and down depending on what you want. But yeah, I agree. That's also my favorite. It's delicious.
And do you have that? I know you've got a number of recipes on your website. Do you have that one specifically on your site as well?
Yes, yeah, we do.
Yeah, great. So there's one that I really like. I'll send it to you afterwards and I'll add it to the show notes. But it's a lady who runs a show called Rainbow Plant Life. And it's quite similar to the one that you just described, Chris. I think it was kind of like you kind of make it into thin strips and you fry it, you know, shallow fry it, and then you add all the sauce. But I think the sauce is kind of soy sauce, but they also use ketchup as a sort of a little cheat with, I think, like maple syrup and stuff. But I think it is amazing. And I totally agree with you. What one thing that you said earlier, though, Ellen, I think was about shredding it, which I haven't tried yet. But that you could put in pasta bolognese, right?
Exactly. You can just grate it and then just add, you know, whatever you would do with a beef mince, I guess, and then cook it. And it just creates this really sort of, yeah, it's really satisfying. Obviously with tempeh, because it's so sort of dense, it's really filling as well. So it's got quite a nice little bite to it and it absorbs the flavors really well as well. So yeah, I'd highly recommend that.
Yeah. So Chris, one thing that you announced on LinkedIn is that you did a marathon in Valencia. And I was like, I was super impressed with your time, actually. I've only managed to do half a marathon in my life, but maybe one day I'll do a marathon. But you just did it in over 2.5 hours. How much was that related to the tempeh that you were eating?
Yeah, it's difficult to say because, you know, I eat tempeh all the time, and I was eating tempeh way before training for this marathon. I am still eating this tempeh, you know, eating tempeh every single day after this marathon is done. So it's difficult to know exactly what impact it had, but it definitely had some impact. Like, undoubtedly, it was my chief source of protein throughout all the months that I was training. It boosted my recovery, so I was able to run, you know, 4 or 5 days in a row. It's very difficult to hack your way to fast marathon time. Unfortunately, it just is about getting the volume in, going out, and just getting as much mileage under your belt as you can in any given week. That's honestly like probably the only tried and tested way of getting faster for a marathon. And eating tempeh to the extent that I was, you know, probably like every single day, allowed me to recover the next day to tackle another big run day after day.
Yeah. And are you thinking of taking on more sort of marathons and maybe any other cities, maybe New York?
Yeah, no.
Don't get Chris.
London.
I mean, I'm hooked. So Valencia last year was my 10th or 11th marathon.
Oh, wow. Jeez. I didn't know you'd done that many.
I've run a few this year to London, the London Marathon in April. And I've also signed with Valencia again in the beginning of December. So
well done.
That's it for those two.
Yeah. And are you raising for any charities when you run, or are you doing something like that? Or
so I used to raise money for charities, but then when people start seeing that, oh, there goes Chris running another marathon, I felt like it became a little bit disingenuous to ask people to, I guess, fund me to do something that I just love and would have done anyway with or without the fundraise. So no, unfortunately, I'm not fundraising for these couple of marathons, but as a business, we do donate, you know, 1% of all of our revenue to supporting this amazing charity in Indonesia called Yum. And the charity's mission is all about alleviating protein, energy, malnutrition. So effectively the lack of protein in the diets of very young children in Indonesia to reduce the rates of stunting. So yeah, I guess Indonesia is the world's third largest country. No, fourth, sorry. Right behind the US in terms of population. Yet 21% of Indonesian children are stunted. So stunted from whether that's mentally stunted in their cognitive development or physically stunted in their physical development. So what we're trying to do by working with this charity is to help alleviate that massive, massive issue. And you know, for us, give back to Indonesia has given us so much.
Yeah, that's great. It's also very good that you're doing 1% on the revenue and not 1% on the profit. So yeah, that's very commendable. So, you know, that's definitely going to be more money potentially, right? I would imagine.
Oh, definitely. Going to them. Yeah. I mean, truth be told, we're not yet profitable. So if it were 1% profits, it'd be
exactly.
It'd be a lie. You know, just be a lie. So
for sure.
You're also registered as B Corp, which is an amazing thing to have achieved because I think it's quite a process to go through, right?
Yes, very excited to be a B Corp, though we can't take too much credit on that, to be honest, because Driando, our co-founder, totally led the process. He smashed it. He was like, he was a man on a mission, wasn't he? I think he loved it. He really enjoyed it. And he did such a great job. So obviously we supported in sharing materials and we had to set stuff up, you know, a lot ahead of time to be, you know, to have a kind of business that would be B Corp certified and to get the score that we got, which was 99.7, I believe. So we're very happy with that. He absolutely smashed it and we're thrilled to be a B Corp.
Great. And what would you say is next now for the company, I guess, in terms of product or innovation or what you're seeing with where the market's going? I'm completely believe where we'll start to see a lot more companies and people actually focusing on less ingredients, more whole food, plant-based products, or what you call clean label, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I guess, you know, for us this year, it's really just doubling down on everything that we know works. So over the last 8 months, we've been through this crazy growth journey. You know, over the last 8 months, we launched into Tesco. We then launched into Whole Foods. We then launched into Lidl. We then launched into Asda just this month, in January, just last month. So it's been through, you know, the business has been on this massive, massive growth trajectory. And no doubt we have every, you know, faith that it will continue on that trajectory. But we also need to be cognizant and be completely clear on what is working and how can we continue to make the things that are working work even better. So whether that's in terms of our sales strategy, that comes down to really doubling down on securing greater distribution here in the UK, working more closely with the retail partners that we already are to see if there are any opportunities for further growth within them, whether we can get new products in. You know, from a product development perspective, it's really, you know, we spoke about it earlier, but doubling down on the fact that our consumers are buying tempeh because they see it as a staple. So what other products can we introduce that could make tempeh easier to adopt as a staple? So whether it's like lightly seasoned products, whether it's products in more familiar formats to other protein staples that they may already be consuming or consuming alongside with tempeh. So that's, yeah, some really exciting developments there to be announced hopefully soon. And I guess from a marketing perspective, I'll let Ellen take it.
Yeah, I think our goal this year really is just going more mainstream, as I said earlier. I think what we've done over the last few years is really create that core audience for tempeh, which has been vital. And I think, you know, most people will agree that's what you need to do as you're starting a business to get those sort of super fans. And we have a very loyal customer base. But now it's about how can we, you know, how can we target those lighter buyers? How can we target the people that haven't heard of tempeh before and really encourage them to try it, you know, on the shelf to make it clear, what is this about? How can they use it? And that's really the focus, as well as I said earlier, you know, meeting people where they're consuming their healthy sort of protein staples and just, yeah, trying to build that awareness around tempeh and, of course, us as the leading tempeh brand as well.
Brilliant. Awesome. And so, yeah, I guess if anybody out there hasn't tried it, please go and try it. And it's fantastic that you've brought it to the mainstream. And we definitely want to see more healthier foods on the market. So well done to you both and the rest of the founders as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So thanks very much for coming on the show, and I'll see you again soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Take
Bye.
care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.